Take me out to the ball game. Take me out with the crowd.
It's hot, it's muggy, it's summer, and the boys of summer continue to play the quintessential American game of baseball. The next time you sit and watch a baseball game, ponder this. Does the weather and surrounding atmospheric conditions affect the great American pastime? We'll find out as jet streaming continues. The topics we cover here on jet streaming are wide-ranging. Baseball and the weather is first up to the plate. I guess I'm the leadoff pitcher. I'm Kathy Werzer. With me, teammates Mark Seely and Paul Huttner. I'm going to quote the baseball references right now. How are you guys?
Doing great, Kathy. How are you?
So far, so good.
Very good. I'm ready to come out of the dugout.
You look like you're ready. Your mitt, your Huttner's got his bat.
Mark's our closer on this thing.
I'm good. Now, we should say to folks that Paul's involved in Little League Baseball. You're a coach, right?
Yep, coach for East Tonka Little League in the Western Metro, and it's a gas.
I bet it is, watching the little kids.
Oh, it's the American pastime. It's a beautiful thing.
Now, no doubt you keep close tabs on the weather before and during your games, obviously. Have you ever wondered how the weather affects the physics of the game?
I have. It's quite amazing. Looking forward to hearing our wonderful guest today.
Well, with us is Professor Bob Adair from Yale University. He's the godfather on this topic, highly quoted because he wrote the book Physics of Baseball back in 1990, a bestseller. It's been published since in numerous revisions, and Professor Adair joins us this morning. Good morning to you.
Good morning.
How'd you get interested in this topic of physics and baseball?
Well, I used to attend baseball games with my grandfather when I was a little kid, and of course everybody played baseball all the time then. And then at Yale, I was a friend of Bart Giamatti. Bart had 1,000 friends, but I was one of them. And when he became left as president of Yale and became president of the National League, a position which no longer exists, he realized that he had some problems that maybe a physicist could address. And he knew that I was somebody he could talk to about baseball at Yale, and I knew something about it, and I was a competent physicist. So he called me up one evening and asked if I would be a consultant to the National League. And I would be paid about 0.1% of what Barry Bonds is paid.
Yeah.
That's still a lot of money. And I said, no, Bart, I didn't want to do that. I didn't know that I could do any good. But tell me what you want, and I'll see if I can help. And so he wrote me a letter with 3 carefully phrased questions. And I looked into it, and I had a lot of fun. It was really a lot of fun. And I wrote him 3 articles on his questions and wrote it for, he's a very intelligent man, but not a technical man. So I wrote it non-technical, but for a very intelligent man who knew baseball.
I got to ask you, of course, in a nutshell, the 3 questions he wanted to know about.
Well, he wanted to know about cork bats, about deface baseballs, and how the devil one was going to play Major League Baseball in Denver.
Say, speaking of Denver, Professor Adair, this is Mark Seely. The air density question comes up over and over again since the publishing of your book. Across the range of Major League Baseball parks in this country, as well as Canada, and then also thinking in terms of the normal variations in atmospheric pressure during the summer season, does it significantly affect the speed of fastballs or the break on curveballs? Because I've heard a lot of speculation about that.
Well, the fastball come over a couple inches faster, but not that's about all. The curveballs won't break quite as much, and the fastball won't hop quite as much. Maybe enough to make a difference.
I see. And then the other thing regarding atmospheric pressure as well as atmospheric humidity, there's a lot in your book and others have written on this topic in terms of its effect on the ball itself. But what about any effects on the bat? Are there any significant physics associated with the bat?
That's an easy question to answer. No.
Oh, gotcha. Okay.
Professor Adair, Paul Huttner here. Thanks for being with us today. The big question I always get and everybody wants to know to dovetail on what Mark was saying and with respect to Denver and even Atlanta, which is the second highest ballpark in the nation by altitude at about 1,000 feet, the effect of air density on baseballs, the flight of the ball, will those home runs go farther? Now, I read somewhere that a 400-foot home run at sea level would go about 408 feet in Atlanta and as far as 440 feet in Denver. Can you explain, first of all, is that true? And if so, explain to our Jetstream streaming listeners why that's the case.
It's a good approximation. Actually, I think I'd cut it down a little. We now have some better measurements. That's probably more like 425-foot in Denver, and maybe 404 feet in Atlanta.
And what is that? That's the the drag in the atmosphere, right? Created by
air slowing the ball up. It's that simple. To calculate it turns out to be extraordinarily tricky for complicated reasons.
Could you explain to me, please, how, when you look at, say, Coors Field, going back to Denver here for just a second, Professor, how does the microclimate at Coors Field affect the game at all, if much at all?
Well, the wind direction there is, I have forgotten that offhand what it is, but it's a little different. I think it tends to be because of the mountain structures and everything. There's more wind from the east than from the west, maybe a little more from the south than from the north. That affects things considerably. And, of course, basically it's the air pressure, which is the big determinant.
And gentlemen here gathered with me, are those elements microclimates found in other stadiums, to the best of your knowledge?
Well, every stadium has a microclimate in a sense, in that over the United States we have a prevailing west wind. We all know that climate goes from west to east. And if you measure the wind on the average place in the United States, it's going to blow from the west appreciably more than it is from the east. But just exactly what the terrain is and stuff like that can change it. Like, as I say, as I understand it, it's a little different in Denver.
Professor Adair, I wanted to consider the context of history here for a minute. Back across the history of American baseball, we went from what was once a softer ball to a harder ball in the early 20th century and saw quite a change in home runs. And then in our lifetime, we went from a relatively higher pitching mound to a lower pitching mound. And I'm wondering, did you ever consider the physics in terms of that lowered pitching mound that we saw come into play a few decades ago?
Well, the pitching mound difference is only about 2 inches. And as far as the so-called dead ball and so forth, there's not all that much information on it. My own feeling is the ball didn't change much.
Dr. Adair, pitchers, they love to throw breaking stuff. They love it when the ball moves. And another little tidbit I found is that a crosswind can affect how the baseball moves, obviously. A 10-mile-an-hour crosswind can cause a pitch to break a few more inches. Does that make sense to you intuitively and technically, scientifically?
Oh, yes, of course. the 2 inches, it's 2 inches more in one direction and 2 inches less in the other.
Sure, but that can be a big deal when you're trying to hit a 95-mile-an-hour fastball and the ball moves 2 inches on you with the bat.
Well, actually, the 2 inches left-right doesn't make all that much difference, and that's why a major league curveball is much more a drop than it is a left-to-right movement. The left-to-right movement is of some importance, certainly, but it's the drop, the 6 to 12, of the 12 to 6 motion, as they like to call it.
Okay, a couple more quick questions here locally, because we play baseball in a dome, and for years there have been rumors that the Minnesota Twins have turned the air conditioning on when the Twins are up to get those fans blowing, with the theory being that the ball travels farther. Perhaps it's a microclimate with winds in the outfield when those fans are blowing, or a pressure thing. Any wisdom in that kind of a scenario?
It's a lovely, it's a charming story. One I'm familiar with. And yeah, it could make it could change the probability of hitting a home run a percent or two. I rather doubt that it happens, though.
One more question here. Now, you're more concerned with physics. I don't suppose you've looked into this, but we're now building an outdoor baseball stadium for the Twins. I'm going to look into this, the average number of rainouts in northern cities in outdoor stadiums, but I'm guessing Cleveland, Milwaukee, Chicago, New York City, we're going to have quite a few more of those here in the spring and fall here in the Twin Cities.
Well, you don't have as much. You have, in Minneapolis, you have, about 22 inches of rain a year, something like that?
Yeah, that's about right.
New York City, New Haven, where I live, it's more like 45 inches. So there's a difference there.
No kidding. Say, by the way, when you look at all these various elements, all these things we've just been talking about the past few minutes, how do you do your calculations? What kind of technology do you use, if you use a lot of technology at all?
Let us say our detailed and deep understanding of how a baseball moves through fluid air and things like that is not very well founded. It's a very tricky business. As I tell people, if Albert Einstein were alive today and interested in baseball, the second being not much more likely than the first, he could not calculate from first principles how a ball curves.
Really?
That's right. And so it's a question of approximations and estimates and so forth, which is, for an experimental physicist like myself, great fun.
Gee, I suddenly have a lot more sympathy for those Minnesota Twins that are hitting less than 300.
Well, they're paid.
They get paid
well.
Either way. That's right.
Oh, Professor, we appreciate your time here this morning. Thank you. It's been a wonderful conversation.
Well, thank you. It's fun for me.
Thank you. That's Professor Bob Adair from Yale University. He's the author of the best-selling book, The Physics of Baseball.
Rain, 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 beautiful rain. Rain, 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 beautiful rain. Oh, come, never come. Oh, come, never come. Oh, come to me, beautiful rain.
Oh. And it did rain hard for hours this week back in 1987, July 23rd, as a matter of fact, when the Twin Cities of Minneapolis and St. Paul were hit with what some people call the storm of the century. This was a doozy. Mark Seely, you were caught in this storm, were you not?
I was stranded in downtown St. Paul for the evening, indeed, like so many others. Best thing to do during a storm like that is just stay put.
Well, I was a reporter, and I was not staying put. I was doing live shots. And of course, Mr. Huttner with his TV background knows how fun that can be.
Yes, a live shot in a flash flood. That's lovely.
Yes. Well, one of the National Weather Service meteorologists on duty that night some 20 years ago. 20 years ago is Rich Neistat. Rich was the Weather Service's science officer until recently, because Rich Neistat is now retired, but always good to talk with you. How are you, Rich?
Just fine, Kathy.
Okay, take me back here 20 years ago, July 23rd, 1987. What was going on at that time?
Okay, well, it was interesting. It was actually my day off, and the day before I had worked, and we had looked at the weather pattern, and we knew it was going to be a stormy afternoon and evening and night coming up the next day, the 23rd, and went into work, and as soon as the first radar echoes developed west of the Twin Cities, we started to slap out severe thunderstorm warnings, and it was like, you know, something that you wouldn't even put a warning out for. It looked on radar, but we knew the atmosphere was explosive. 45 minutes later, we got a report of golf ball size hail, and what some of your listeners may not know at the Weather Service, it's like, yes, we verified. So it's kind of kind of fun when we do something like that.
High fives.
So, yeah. You know, especially if, you know, there's no injuries and that type of thing, of course. So a little bit later, we started getting reports of funnel clouds around Maple Grove, and we had a tornado warning out before the tornado actually touched down. So we were feeling pretty good about ourselves, put out just a huge number of severe thunderstorm warnings during the evening, and I think just, you know, one or two tornado warnings. And it got to be much later in the evening, around 10:30, 11 p.m., and one of our media partners called us up and said, you know, you guys are doing a great job with all these severe weather warnings, but I don't know if you're aware about how the water is just piling up everywhere across the Twin Cities, and, you know, you might be thinking about flooding and flash flooding and statements and warnings. And that was really what helped direct us, because we tend to get, or we used to get, very focused on, like, the severe aspect, and maybe the flooding aspect was not dealt with quite as directly. So it was helpful, certainly, to have the media pointing that out. And, of course, it rained and rained, and what we know now and what we knew back then are totally different in the world of meteorology. The storms kept developing just west of the Twin Cities and moving across the Twin Cities, and we're going, yeah, it's going to end in another hour. Well, more would pop up. Well, maybe another hour and another hour. And so, you know, we had flash flood warnings out. I think we ended up with something absurd like exactly 10 inches of rain. I mean, how weird is that?
Mm-hmm.
And I believe Mark might remember back, and maybe Paul or even Kathy, that earlier that week, maybe 2 days earlier, parts of Bloomington had received just a monstrous amount of rain. So they got the double whammy.
Yes, I recall that week as being turbulent with those heavy rains earlier in the week, and perhaps adding to the boundary layer water vapor that was available for the storm that occurred on July 23rd. I also note, Rich, that at one point during that, what was dominantly a six-hour storm on July 23rd, 10 inches in 6 hours, that the recording rain gauge registered 1.55 inches in 30 minutes, which in my memory at least might be the maximum intensity we've ever had in the Twin Cities area.
That's really interesting, because we do a lot with radar estimates, and we kind of cap them off around 2.5 inches per hour. If you've multiplied two times what you said, you know, you're up a little bit over 3 inches. But there are, you know, reports or estimates of considerably higher, but those are estimates, and you would certainly be one of the authorities on knowing what has happened in the Twin Cities. So, yeah, that's a tremendous amount of rain in a short period of time.
Rich, Paul Huttner here, and I'm looking at the map, the isopleth map of the rainfall amounts for this storm. A big 10-inch swath from Lake Minnetonka through Deephaven, Minnetonka, Edina, Eden Prairie, and then on into Richfield, and points southeast. But even at that, this storm, as heavy as it was, really affected mostly about half of the Twin Cities area. And as weather forecasters, a lot of us know that these are some of the most difficult events to forecast that we have. These what we call weak synoptic scale events, where there aren't a lot of clear signals on the weather maps, and we get a little what we call mesoscale event going on that affects a very localized area like this. Talk a little bit about how well this was forecast in terms of the heavy rain and flash flood potential, and just how difficult these storms are to forecast.
Well, what was really ironic about this storm is one of my former colleagues, who's also retired, on the midnight shift, we actually had a forecast of heavy rain in for the coming night. And on the day shift, that particular colleague, who obviously will not have a name today, was really quite proud in that he took the heavy rain out of the forecast. And he had what at the time seemed to be like sound meteorological reasoning for doing that. It wasn't too much after that that we realized, well, that's exactly what you don't look for. And so he, you know, what we've learned in the decades since is we've got a whole bevy arsenal of meteorological issues that we look at, and so we go with the weight of the evidence. And so he jumped on the opportunity to take the heavy rain out, because the forecaster who'd been on the midnight shift, to be honest, he liked to forecast heavy rain all the time. So the you know, we are a little bit kind of going in the wrong direction on that. But as far as these mesoscale events, they're basically small scale events, as you alluded to. Our understanding of them has really increased over the last 20 years, and I'm sure we would do a much better job now than we did back then. You know, we have the equivalent sometimes in the wintertime where we get 8 to 12 inch snow bands, and they're maybe only 40 miles wide. And so our understanding of that is at a high level, whereas back then it was just kind of playing like catch-up meteorology.
Rich, in that historical context, I can't help but think, back in 87, did the Weather Service have the QPF tool, the quantified precip forecast?
Well, we made quantitative precipitation forecasts. I'm not sure exactly what tool you're referring
to. In other words, I think as technologies evolved over time, today's estimates using QPF are a little bit better than they were 20 years ago, are they not?
Well, I suspect you're talking about the radar estimates. Is that right?
No, the actual forecast.
The
24 and 48-hour products.
Right, yes. Yes, we had them back then. They're more accurate today. But when it comes to mesoscale events, there's certainly room to improve.
Ah, okay.
To be very nice about that. And, in fact, one of my colleagues in the Sioux Falls office, my counterpart, the science officer there, he's quite fond and quite correct in saying that the worst forecast that comes out of these computer models is the quantitative precipitation forecast. In other words, how much water is going to form. So we look at a lot of other things, the amount of instability, the strength of the lift, things like that.
Just to wrap up on that, Rich, the Minnesota history shows that we've only had a handful of events of this intensity. So our historical knowledge base on this kind of event is very limited indeed.
Well, that is true, of course. But what's nice is, and especially with the acquisition of the Weather Event Simulator and in all the weather forecast offices, we're able to examine similar cases all across the country. So it doesn't have to occur in Minnesota for us to go back and research it and learn from that.
Good point.
As I mentioned, Rich, I was a reporter that night, and I was chasing the tornadoes, which when the news crews went out, that's what we were going for. And as you mentioned, then other stations were calling you saying, well, wait a minute, we have some severe flooding. But my question is, at the time, since that system was dropping tornadoes, was there something, is that fairly unusual when you have a system like this where you have tornadic activity and then all of a sudden, boom, you get hit with really heavy rain?
It's not unusual for the tornadoes to occur at the beginning of the weather event out of these supercells, as we call them. They're very discrete, you know, separate storms. And as all the heat is released from the storms upstairs in the atmosphere, so to speak, they kind of form an amorphous mass, and so they all kind of congeal together. Then you end up with a wind event and a heavy rain event. But what I remember clearly, July 23rd, in that what was unusual, after the tornadoes had, you know, said we're done for the evening, and it transitioned to a heavy rain event, occasionally right in the middle of the heavy rain event, we'd get all this large hail, and then it would go back to just the heavy rain. That was a bit of a puzzler.
I bet it was.
I know, Rich, a couple of the other big events we had, June of 1892, as far as the top three rain producers here for the metro, that one ranking second with 7.36 inches, or I should say 7.8 inches. And then August 30th, 1977, 7.36 inches, ranking third. This superstorm pretty much dwarfed those. 11.32 inches of rain documented in the northeast part of Eden Prairie, near the border with Edina. Obviously, these things are few and far between, and maybe Mark can weigh in on this as a climatologist, but we talk about a 100-year storm. You know, what is a 100-year storm, and how often do they occur? I think people wonder, because it seems to me, my observation, we get them more often than every 100 years.
Good point, and it depends on whether you calculate the 100-year storm from point-specific data, that is a single station like MSP Airport, for example, versus an area. Because when you expand those calculations to include a spatial area like the Twin Cities area, it greatly inflates the numbers. So, for example, if you looked at Twin Cities Airport alone, you might calculate, well, now in the modern context, a 100-year recurrence interval for 24 hours of 10 inches, because obviously we've measured it. But if you expanded that to include the area, you'd get a larger value. You might get a value more like 12 or 14 inches or something like that.
Mm-hmm. Comment, Rich?
I totally agree with that. I remember people giving us a hard time about if it's a 100-year flood, how come they keep occurring more than once every 100 years? But I think Mark did a great job of explaining that.
Well, and I bet you learned a lot from that storm some 20 years ago.
Well, we learned a lot. One of the interesting things is one of the prominent researchers had said, well, I can't believe they dropped the ball. They should have had a flash flood watch out. They should have been watching this. They must not be keeping up to date in the science. And the fact is that the situational awareness was less than optimum because we were spread so thin. But actually, one of our lead forecasters at work, who's still working to this day, Bill Togstead, was invited to go out to Boulder and actually research the event with some of the most notable meteorological researchers in the country. And he and those researchers wrote a very nice article and really helped our understanding of what happened. And so I don't think we've had a repeat event in terms of, you know, being surprised by it. And so we're able actually to anticipate things like that. If we were given a second chance, I think we do a great job.
I'm sure. Well, it was fun reminiscing with you, Rich, as always. Thanks so much.
You're welcome.
That's Rich Nystad, retired National Weather Service Science Officer at Minneapolis-St. Paul International Airport. Always great to have Rich aboard. I remember getting back home and ringing. I opened my car door and all this rain, all this water came out of the car. I was driving through streets I should not have been driving through, and oh, it was a mess.
They're memorable events, and everybody has a story about those events. They stick in your mind a long time.
Oh, yes, they do. Now, here is a listener question, which Dr. Seeley, I think, is perfect for this particular podcast. And this is, of course, about the 87 storm, which, of course, was one of the all-time greatest rainfall intensity for residents of Minneapolis-St. Paul. But this listener wants to know, what level of rainfall intensity has been measured elsewhere in the world?
Well, some incredible numbers, Kathy. If we look at National Weather Service statistics for the USA alone, we can find Unionville, Maryland had 1.23 inches in 1 minute.
No.
Now, that's a shower faucet intensity.
Yeah. It's a hose.
Yeah.
And then Alvin, Texas is still the record holder for 24 hours with 43 inches on July 25th, 1979. And obviously, that was a stalled tropical storm over southern Texas. And then one that boggles my mind is the world record for a one-hour intensity, which is at Nay Mongol in China, at 15.7 inches in 1 hour on August 1st, 1977.
Get out.
Again, that's even hard to fathom, isn't it? Almost 16 inches of rain in 1 hour. Locally here in the Twin Cities and across the central part of Minnesota, for example, our 100-year, 1 hour intensity recurrence calculation is about 2.5 to 3 inches per hour. So imagine five times that.
No, I cannot. Wow, that is amazing. Don't you just, you gotta
love the
weather.
That's a year's worth of rain for many desert locations.
No, no kidding.
Yeah.
Let us move on, friends, to the weather website of the week. Yes. Paul Huttner.
Well, speaking of storms and lightning, right? A lightning part of storms, and there's a kind of a cool website you can use to keep track of lightning strikes. It's called Star Strike US. And it's just that, starstrikeus.com. And basically, they have regional maps, national map, where they plot real-time lightning strikes, cloud-to-ground strikes, and during the last 60 minutes of lightning. And you can get the strike rate and see where all the lightning is. So kind of a cool place to check out, starstrikeus.com.
I bet you when you are at home, do you click through that? As you
most people are out relaxing on the hammock. You're clicking on Star Strike. I'm afflicted. What can I say?
I understand. That's good. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you, Paul Huttner, Mark Seeley. Appreciate it.
Thanks, Kathy.
Good show, Kathy.
It was fun. That's going to do it for Jet Streaming, by the way, one of the podcasts created by Minnesota Public Radio. If you have a question for the Jet Streaming crew, don't be shy. Drop us a line by going to jetstreaming@minnesotapublicradio.org. Until next week, remember to keep your eyes on the sky.
Keep on the sunny.